This building is fitted in.
Could be that, like, the bookcase was banged against the thing that turns it on and off.
My friend fitted it across.
Thanks. Anyone ready to roll? Okay, greetings, everyone. Nice to be back. And there is a very obscure passage in the Talmud, Babylonian Talmud, Rosh Hashanah, 20b. I'm going to look at that passage. There is a medieval rabbi, the name of Rabbi Isaac Israeli II. There are actually a few Isaac Israelis. I'm speaking the one who lived in Spain and wrote a work in 1310 called Yesod Olam, Foundation of the World. I've spoken about this before. And there he has an analysis in Book 4, Chapter 8. He has an analysis of this passage of the Talmud. First, I want to run through the passage of the Talmud and point out what some of the difficulties or the obscurities are, and then work through in diagram form some of the resolutions proposed by Israeli, and then maybe look a little bit at some of his texts, but I don't think we'll do that in the end. So the passage starts as follows. I broke it down by Roman numerals. Roman numeral 1. Samuel said, I'm able to arrange it, meaning the Jewish calendar, for the entire diaspora. Okay, number 2. These numbers are mine. The passage is not numbered. I should point out that obviously the Babylonian Talmud was edited. There are editors, there are redactors, and presumably this made sense to someone somewhere along the line. But as Israeli quotes, especially towards the end of the passage, I'm just going to quote some things that I didn't include in the handout. Since some of the medieval rabbis said that they can't make any sense of aspects of this passage, they don't know what it's about. I just want to give the exact quote. Bear with me for a moment. Rabbi Chaya Gon, or often called Chai Gon, says the following. He says, as for this Shemaitisa, as for this tradition that Rabbi Nachman will see later on, it's towards the end of the quote that I give, Rabbi Nachman said that for 24 hours the moon is non-sightable, we know neither what it is saying nor how this can be. A number of times we were queried regarding it, and had we found any meaning in it, we would have stated it. I state as a fundament that it is not something that is precise. So Rabbi Chaya Gon says that there's something strange in this passage, it just doesn't make sense. And then he quotes also, Isaac Israeli quotes Rabbi Hananel also, and he says, regarding this statement that if it was born before midday or after midday, which is another piece that we'll look at, and also what Rabbi Nachman said, for 24 hours the moon is non-sightable, it has not become properly clear to us, and therefore we have not written any commentary on it. And indeed, if you look at the printed editions of the Talmud, you see that these words are there in the printed edition as well. He said he doesn't know what it means, and he says he quotes certain obscurities that other commentators mention, and he ends off saying that unlike Rabbi Chaya Gaon, it is a very precise thing if you know how to understand it. So now let's look at what some of the problems are and what his resolutions are. Okay, so we had this first statement that Samuel is claiming that he is able to make a calendar. He is able to arrange a calendar for the diaspora. Now, in addition to resolving the astronomical problems in this passage, Isaac Israeli actually gives a running commentary. He tries to deal with the entire literary unit, and he explains piece by piece and step by step the logic that unfolds in this passage. And he explains about this, what was bothering Samuel. And he discusses this in several places in part 4, that the Jews living in Babylonia did not celebrate some of the holidays on the same day as the Jews living in Israel and Jerusalem, etc. And which is an interesting idea in itself, that there it shows that, you know, it's possible, it was acceptable to celebrate, you know, the one community celebrates this on one day and another community celebrates it the next day. In Babylonia they celebrated a day earlier, in Israel they celebrated a day later, and that was because in Israel they had a court, a religious court, and they would have witnesses show up and say, we witnessed the new crescent of the moon, and then they would declare the new month on that basis very often. Whereas it was, and that's the place where it had to be done. It had to be done in the land of Israel. Whereas the Babylonians didn't know what was happening in Israel, there's no good way of communication, and they couldn't do it themselves there. And so Samuel is trying to give them a way to know what must be going on in the land of Israel. Through astronomy, just to understand what must be unfolding, what must be happening in the land of Israel, so they can know what the court in Israel must be doing now, just based on the astronomy of it. Do you have a question?
If I'm allowed to interrupt, sorry.
If it's brief. Now, other guys will be,
yes,
at the end, we'll,
so.
Yeah. Just for clarification, really.
Yes.
If it's not for clarification, we'll just hold it for it, really.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't want to get into all the controversies of whether it's decided in the land of Israel or it can be decided elsewhere, if that's what you're going to ask about.
It will be too distracting.
Okay, so we'll come back to everything. Okay. So he was trying, and he said that the people were not happy with this situation, that they weren't keeping the holidays on the same day, and Samuel was trying. So as he contextualizes this passage in the Talmud, he explains from his point of view that's the quest, that was Samuel's quest. And now in section 2, Abba, the father of Rabbi Simalai, said to Samuel, does the master, referring to Samuel in the third person in a very respectful way, in other words, Samuel, know that which we learned in the Sod of the Ibor? Now, Sod may mean there are various theories of what the word Sod means. One, literally the word Sod means secret. So either this means that there are certain very difficult topics, astronomical topics, that had to be understood to function with the calendar. Or it means that there was a council, an inner group, an inner core of people who met, either way. And then there were certain teachings regarding the calendar, certain pieces of information that emerged from this about the Jewish. And the Ibor simply means the Jewish calendar, the calendar. Literally, it means impregnation, but without getting into the whole thing, it means the Jewish calendar. So does Samuel, you who are trying to work out the system, so do you know the meaning of one of these teachings that has to do with the Jewish calendar? If it, namely the moon, was born, nolad, and we'll see a little bit more about this word nolad, it's a precise term, and Israeli will analyze it and give more precision to it. If it was born before midday, then there's one law that applies, and if it was born after midday there's another law that applies. And Samuel had to admit no. Whereupon Abba said, since the master, namely Samuel, doesn't know this, there are other matters that the master does not know, and therefore Samuel was, according to Abba, was disqualified from being able to set up a calendar for the Babylonians. And they're back to square one. They now have to just keep on doing it the way they'd been doing it until then and be a day off, possibly, from what's happening in the land of Israel and celebrate their holidays on a different day. And now, when Rabbi Zerah went up to the land of Israel, that's a phrase in the Talmud, going up. It's a Babylonian Talmud, and they speak about going up from Babylonia to the land of Israel. He sent word back to them, back to the people, the folks back in Babylon. And he gave certain teachings. There must be a night and a day of the new moon, in other words. What that means, is totally obscure without any commentary, but I'll just jump ahead and tell you what the consensus, what Israeli explains. It means from... we'll hold off on that. We'll get into that in a minute. But there, before it actually appears, from a certain important point called the conjunction until the actual possible of sightability of the moon, there has to be a night and a day. In other words, 24 hours. Actually, I should step in here and explain what this is talking about. Let's look at the diagram on the second page of your handout. This is a diagram from an Oxford manuscript of Isaac Israeli's work. This is one of my favorite manuscripts. I'm editing this work, and I use this manuscript as my first reading. So in the center, we see Haaretz, the earth. And straight up at the top of the page from it, we see the sun, Chama. Now, then we see all different possible positions, not all possible, we see a bunch of different possible positions of the moon around the earth. And we see which part, you know, that half of the moon that is facing the sun is red, will be illuminated, and the half of the moon that's away from the sun will be dark. Now, when we look straight up, we see the earth, and then we see the sun straight up, and in between we see the moon. And there we see that the half of the moon that's facing the sun is exactly the half of the moon that's away from the earth. And there's an alignment. From standing on the earth, you can see that the sun and the moon are aligned with each other. That's called a conjunction. When the two conjoin, the sun and the moon are both conjoined in the same zodiacal area. So obviously one is closer to the earth and one is further, but you can draw a straight line from earth and it'll go through both of them. At that point, you see the moon, the part of the moon that's facing the sun is totally removed from the earth. So on earth, no one is able to see the moon. And now, leading up to that, there's this idea here that the statement that we had here, that from the moment of that conjunction until there'll be enough of a glimmer to, and if you go like over to the, if you go over one, you see there's a little sliver from standing on earth that you can see a little bit of the half of the moon that's illuminated, although most of the part of the moon that's seen is what's not illuminated. On either side you see that, although the diagram wasn't made that great. But in theory it should be that you can, from the earth you see just a little sliver of it, and then as you go more and more you see more and more, until you go into the bottom of the page you see the entire moon illuminated. Okay, so he's saying basically here that from the time of the conjunction, from the time that the two come together, you'll need approximately 24 hours before you can see that first sliver from Earth. Okay, that's the idea here. So that's what Rabbi Zeira's teaching. He went up to the land of Israel, he sent back word to them, there must be a night and a day of the new moon. The new moon is after the conjunction, after the two align, and then the moon starts moving beyond that. That's called the new moon. What happened beforehand is called the old moon. That's the end of the old moon. Okay, so you need 24 hours for that. Okay, that's number three. So Rabbi Zeira, now that we have a teaching coming from the land of Israel. Number four. This is the meaning. That presumably this, picking up, I'm filling in the way Israeli explains this, at least part of what he explains. I'll leave some of it unexplained until we unpack it in detail. This is the meaning of the statement of Abba, Father Rabbi Simalai, which we already saw. We already saw Abba. Where did we see Abba, the son of Rabbi Simalai? That was number two. So what was the statement that he made? That he said to Samuel, if the molad occurred before midday or if it occurred after midday. In other words, we calculate the molad. The molad, we'll see, is another way of referring to, or one of the, or it has something to do with the idea of the conjunction. The molad is not when you can first see the moon, but it's more or less we'll see Israeli will have something to say less, actually, but it's more or less when the conjunction happens. So so he's saying that, but at this point we don't see any, the molad is, at this point, should be understood to be identical to the conjunction, and Israeli will say, actually, it's not that simple. So he says, if the molad occurred before midday or after midday, so we calculate the molad. And if the molad, the birth, in other words, the molad, the conjunction, happened before midday, it is known that the new moon, will be seen close to sunset. If it was not born before midday, it is known that it, the new moon, will not be seen close to sunset. The problem here is that we just said in number 3 that you need 24 hours from the time of the conjunction until you can see the new moon. But from here, the superficial reading of what he says here, it seems that all you need are 6 hours. That if the molad occurs at midday, then you'll be able to see the new moon by sunset. There, from midday to sunset, 6 hours. So is it 24 hours or is it 6 hours? This is a profound conflict, and this is what was bothering some of the rabbis who he quotes earlier and say, we don't know what this means, it's imprecise, we have no idea, so we didn't write commentary on it. They couldn't process this sort of thing. It seems a glaring contradiction right there. Okay, to move on in the passage, but Israeli is saying that this is strange because we just quoted this idea that need from the time of the conjunction you need 24 hours, and then he says this is the meaning of the other statement that says that you need 6 hours from the molad. So how can this be? How can the statement that we need 24 hours be the meaning of the statement that you need 6 hours? Seems strange. That's okay. Now, 5. What practical difference do we derive from this? Who cares how much time is necessary? This has happened. We're speaking about Israel, the middle of the land of Israel, where there are witnesses, and is all done on an ad hoc basis based on sighting. So who cares about all the astronomy? Just have, if you have witnesses who show up and see it, then we know that there's a new moon. And if there are no witnesses, then there was no new moon. Okay, so Rabbi Ashi says we need all these calculations and these rules for confuting witnesses. As the witnesses show up and they claim that they saw the new moon, how do we know that's only a very thin crescent at that time, a very thin sliver? How do we know that that was actually the new moon that they saw and it wasn't some sort of atmospheric apparition or clouds or something else? We have to know if it's actually astronomically possible for them. And then we cross-examine. If we know that it was astronomically possible, then we cross-examine the witnesses and we base it. But if it was astronomically impossible, we assume one version says that they're false witnesses, another version says, which I think that's not the correct version. The correct just tracing all the manuscripts and going, I think the correct version is the other one. We say that we can't rely on their testimony. We can't accept their testimony. They're not that they're necessarily lying, but they're just confusing something. Okay, now we have the final statement, which is even more obscure. Rabbi Zera said, Rabbi Nachman said, for 24 hours the moon is covered over, non-sightable, which seems to be a third opinion. So he had one opinion that from the conjunction until the sightability we need only 6 hours. Then we had another opinion that from the conjunction until the sightability we need 24 hours, but that's only from the conjunction, which would mean that was only for the new moon, from the moment of the conjunction. So similarly, on the other end, we would need 24 hours, which would mean that the moon is covered in total 48 hours. 24 hours from the time that you can't see the old moon anymore until the conjunction, and then from the conjunction to go further and to 24 hours until you can see the new one. But here we have a statement that says for 24 hours the moon is covered over without any qualification, which seems to mean that the entire thing is 24 hours, which means each one is only 12 hours. So one opinion seems to me that it's 12 hours on each end, the other is 24 hours on each end, and the other that it's 6 hours on each end, which is somewhat confusing. So, and furthermore, this statement goes on to be even more obscure. It says, for us, whoever we are, 6 of those 24 hours are of the old moon, and 18 of those 24 hours are of the new moon. So we already know that the old and the new are determined from the moment of the conjunction. So this seems very strange in and of itself. It seems that somehow it seems that for one group of people, from the time that non-visibility of the old moon lasts only 6 hours, and non-visibility of the new moon lasts 18 hours, and then whereas for them, some other group of people, 6 are of the new, and that means and then 18 are of the old, which seems to make everything even more strange. How do you have, it's an astronomical phenomenon. It's something that happens objectively, not localized. It's something that happens in the heavens in relation to the earth. So what is irrelevant where on earth these people are living? So the whole thing is very obscure. The whole passage is very strange. And so just to summarize, without Israeli, or without some commentary, we wouldn't even, although we have the contradictions and Israeli irons them out, but we wouldn't even get as far to have an intelligent reading of the passage, even with the contradictions. Because he had to fill in a lot of the lines, okay, what exactly we're talking about, but the words themselves are so cryptic that of the new, of the old, what the new what, the old what, you know what I mean? So the birth, what is a birth anyway? So what are all these things? So the whole thing would be even more obscure. Okay, so just to summarize the problems here, we're speaking about the duration of non-sightability. And that duration constitutes the end of the old moon, the moment of the conjunction, and then the beginning of the new moon. For that entire duration, the moon is not sightable. It's not visible. It's impossible to see it from Earth. And the difficulties in this passage, before Israeli steps in, number one, in section 3, it seems that the new moon consists of a night and day, which is 24 hours. In other words, the new moon from the time of the conjunction until you can first see the new moon, that is 24 hours. Now, section 4 seems that just before midday to sunset is the amount of time that you need from the conjunction until the first visibility, which is 6 hours. And section 6 averages out to 12 hours from the conjunction until sightability, and then 12 hours afterwards, 24, the total non-sightability, which would mean only 12 hours from the conjunction until sightability. And that consists of two periods. Okay, the end of the old, and the beginning, to the conjunction, and from the conjunction to the beginning of the moon. But then it gives, instead of saying 12 and 12, it says for some people they're 6 and 18, and other people they're 18 and 6, which is very strange. Okay, now we have, the next page we have the diagram, just to explain the idea of how visibility or non-visibility happens, and we'll see the way that Israeli begins to resolve these problems. And then we're on page 3, and we have to look at the box at the bottom, where he says, let's understand all the terms used here. He said there, we have a few different terms. One term is called, he calls the renewal of the month. And I'll take a step back here. How do we, now we were speaking about conjunction, the molad. The molad really is called, it's really, the way he explains it, we'll see in number 2 here. Let's look at number 1 and number 2. The renewal is a true conjunction. And of Tishrei, this will be at least 22 and a half hours before the first possible sightability of the new moon. So from the time, as we have on this page here, from the time of this alignment here until we actually get to be able to glimpse a crescent, there'll be in the month of Tishrei, there'll be approximately 22 and a half hours. And now we have this other thing called the molad, which is not the true conjunction. The molad is something else. It is a conjunction, but it's only the average or the mean conjunction. Now, what's the difference between the true conjunction and the mean conjunction? The difference is as follows. Let's say you take 19 years, which is the usual cycle, and you say, okay, how many lunations, how many months, how many times, how many cycles of the moon will occur in 19 years? Solar years, 19 solar years. I don't remember, I think it's 235, but I may be wrong. I think it's more than, it comes out to more than 12 per year, average more than 12 per year. And then you say, well, how long does that actually take? Let's measure when the first one happens, and let's measure after the end of 19 years when the last one happens, and we'll divide that amount of time into exactly 235 parts, and then we'll know exactly how long one lunation is. However, that works as a good average. But the moon actually has a very undulous course. It moves closer to the Earth, further from the Earth. Its orbit is not regular. And because of that, not every month does it come out and it's the exact same. So we have an average, but the average is just an average. Well, most months, it won't be the true conjunction won't be the same as the average. So we may say, yes, the molad, he's saying, means the average. Every, you know, we just take the 235 and divide the number of hours, days, hours, and minutes by 235, and we'll know on an average it takes, this is how long the one cycle of the moon takes. But we know, even by observing, that when the moon is closer or when the moon is further, it'll take longer, it'll take less time, etc. Different seasons. So now once we know that, we can look back at the passage and see there's certain places in this passage where it uses the word nolad, molad, was born, and there it's speaking about the average, the molad, the average, the mean conjunction. But now when but other times when it doesn't use nolad or molad, it's speaking about the actual, the true, the real conjunction. And then there'll be different things. So when we speak about the real, the true conjunction, we need for Tishrei, we need 22 and a half hours from the time of the true conjunction until first possible sightability. But when we're speaking about the average, the mean conjunction, number two, the molad, the mean conjunction of the month of Tishrei, that's possible for it to fall up to 14 hours and 648 parts. A part, it would take an hour and divide it into 1,080 parts. So that may, so the average, the mean conjunction may be after the actual renewal. So we think the actual, we know that some astronomically, we know the actual renewal will take place time X, but the average will come out 14 and a half hours later, which is much closer. Now we can already begin to understand this idea that one of them, the one that speaks about Nolad is born, speaks about the six-hour period. Because let's do the math a little bit. So, okay. Now let's we'll do the math in a minute. Well, let's look at the diagram. Here we have the diagram. I made it going from left to right. Some people are thrown off by orienting the map any other way than having east on the right and west on the left. But let's say east is here now. When I'm standing this way, east is on my left. When I'm standing this way, east is on my right. So don't be thrown off by having east on the left. It's the easiest way because English is a left-to-right language, and we're moving in that direction. So we have one half of the globe, the eastern half of the globe, from one end of the inhabited world that in the Middle Ages, that's point A. Now we go across the globe and we get to C, which is the exact midpoint of the inhabited world. This is exactly one half of the globe. And then we continue from C, going sloping downward towards B, which is the western extremity of habitation. That's exactly slicing the globe in half. Now, the middle of the land of Israel is just slightly to the west. We'll see how much to the west from that midpoint of the inhabited earth. These are some points that we have to keep in mind. Now, looking at point number three, the times given for the molad in the Jewish tradition, and this is still done nowadays, we just, in this past Shabbat, we announced that the molad will occur Thursday night, 8, whatever it is, and how many, I don't remember the details of how many parts. So he said, when we speak about the molad, we're not speaking about the true conjunction, we're speaking about the mean conjunction. So, and also, what do you mean that the conjunction, or the, whichever, the real conjunction, true conjunction, or the mean conjunction, will happen at time X? There'll only be one point in the world and longitude, I mean the entire longitude, but one longitude in the world where it will happen at that moment. And then it happens at one moment, exactly one moment, but depending where you are along the sweep from west to east, that moment will be a different time of the day. If you're all the way to the east, it'll be already much later. And if you're to the west, it'll be much earlier. Because when we're here, let's say in England right now, it's 10 minutes to 5. But in America, then the east coast, it's 5 hours earlier. So if something happens now, when we say it happens at 10 minutes to 5, you have to ask, where did it happen at 10? Where was it 10 minutes to 5 when that happened? Well, if it happened when it was 10 minutes to 5 when it happened, then it was 10 minutes to 5 in England. That means in New York, it was 10 minutes to 11. No, to 11? To 12. Yeah, to 12. It was 11:50. 10 minutes to 12. So now there's this tradition. We announce in the synagogue, the molad, the conjunction will take place at this and this time. Where will it happen? Where will it be? So then we have to ask the question, at what point? So that's telling us when we announce that point three, times given for the molad, or for what time it is at point C, the earth's navel, the exact midpoint between east and west of the inhabited world, when the molad falls. But that obviously somewhere else, when that occurrence, if you go a little to the west, it'll be earlier in the day. If you go more to the east, it'll be later in the day. So there's only one spot. And that spot, he claims, he argues against other people, is the point C, the navel of the earth, the exact midpoint. Now, he says, number four, in contrast, when we speak about first sightability and the witnesses and the court, that's all focused around the land of Israel, which is point D, which is a little bit to the west of the navel. Okay, now how much to the west is that? Point D is, that's number five, point D is approximately 1 hour and 612 parts to the west of point C, of the navel of the earth. Thus, sunset, which is in a Jewish clock, the day begins and ends with sunset. So that's either hour 0 or hour 24, on the 24-hour clock. So the sunset, which is 24 hours at point D, is actually, the sunset, which is 24 hours at point D, is 7 hours and 612 parts after midday, which is 18 hours at point C. In other words, you have 6 hours from noon to sunset, plus the 1 hour and 612 parts, which is around a third of an hour, because we have a new point of orientation. So when it says in the Talmud that if the molad occurs at time X, then it will be seen, then the new moon will be seen at sunset, we're saying that if this mean, the average conjunction of Tishrei, occurs at the navel of the earth by midday, before midday, then it's possible that in the land of Israel, the new moon will be seen because it's actually 7 and a third hours later. And it's not from the actual conjunction, it's only from the mean conjunction, but we know for Tishrei, the mean conjunction can be 14 hours and 648 parts after the actual conjunction. So if you add it up, it comes out to the same thing. It comes out to that 22 and a half hours. Let's see how that works out. So 14 hours and the 648 parts, the amount by which the molad may precede the renewal. That means the average, the molad is the average, and the renewal is the actual, plus the 7 hours and 612 parts, the amount by which sunset in Israel follows the noon at the navel, equals 22 hours, 180 parts. So this is 360 parts, what are we missing? So we want to get to 22 and a half hours, but the 180 parts are not a half hour. So we have 22 hours and 180 parts. So this is 360 parts. 360 parts are the same as one third of an hour shy of 22.5 hours, which is the first possible time of sightability from the renewal, the actual conjunction, the true conjunction, which will thus be 1/3 of an hour after sunset. So at sunset, the new moon will still not be visible in the land of Israel, but 1/3 of an hour later, the moon will be visible. Now, 1/3 of an hour, that is the only window of opportunity on the first night to actually see the moon. When it's still light outside, before the sun sets, the light of the sun overwhelms that thin crescent. It's impossible, really, to see the crescent properly at sunset. But now, the moon is going to set 1/3 of an hour later anyway, because the moon is almost, they're almost, the sun and the moon are almost aligned, but they just split apart a little bit. So the sun is now only slightly ahead of the moon. You go through the month, they diverge more and more until the moon stays out longer and longer into the night until it actually drifts into the day. Okay, so what we have here, we have 1/3 of an hour, and that first night of the month, that's a window of opportunity for the sighting of the moon. So once after sunset, 1/3 of an hour. That's the only possible time. And if you add that 1/3 of an hour, we get to 22.5 hours. Thus, if when the molad occurs at point C, it is 18 hours or earlier of day 29. That means the last day, possibly. That's a question. I should have said something about this here. The average length of a month. Average length of a month is it's approximately 29 and a half days. That makes difficulties. Do you make this? So sometimes the month ends up being 30 days, sometimes it ends up being 29 days. We never start the new month somewhere in the middle of the day. So there's always a question on the 29th day of the month. Is this the last day of the old month, and is day 30 going to actually be day 1 of the new month? Or is this going to be one of those months that has 30 days, and this has to be day 30 of old month, and day 1 of new month will not be until day 31. So what we have here is, if in day 29, at point C, the molad, the mean conjunction, occurs for Tishrei at 18 hours, which means noon or earlier, then there is a chance that because of this gap of 14 hours plus, that the new moon and the other one in a change, the new moon will be sightable at point D, which is the center of the land of Israel, when at point D it is 1/3 of an hour, 360 parts, into day 30. And that day will therefore be possibly the day one of the new month. It'll be only 29 days in the old month. However, if when the molad occurs at point C, it is later than 18 hours of day 29, then it will be impossible for the new moon to be sightable at point D, the land of Israel, when at point D it is 1/3 of an hour into day 30, and therefore there'll be 30 days in that month, and the new month will not start until day 31. I don't think we're going to get to the next set of the diagrams. That's a whole new intricacy of its own. We'll have to save that for who knows when, some other occasion. I just want to summarize and run through the way he patches this up, except for the last piece, which we didn't get to. The last piece is, I'll just say a little bit about it, but he has two or three ways, like 2.5 ways of trying to work out the last piece. So we already know two things. We already know we have to look at two different times. One is the true conjunction, and the other is the molad, which is the mean conjunction. Okay, and that though they will be different, and those so section 4 and section 2, which speak about from midday to sunset, are speaking about the molad of Tishrei, specifically the month of Tishrei, and orienting the molad to point C, and the sightability to point D. Okay, so that's just over 6 hours. And when he speaks about 24 hours, he's speaking not from the molad, but from the true conjunction. So for that, we need 24 hours. And the end, he says, when Rabbi Nachman said for 24 hours the moon is covered over, This still remains slightly difficult, and he gives it several different angles. One, he says, it's speaking only about the new moon. And that's the topic here. The topic is not the both ends. The topic is only the second half of the process. So when he says 24 hours, he's actually saying the same thing as the earlier teaching that we had, a day and a night. Because it's not speaking about the total time. And then he gets into more complexities, and he says the truth is there's actually more than 24 hours, actually 48 hours. But if you go to certain points, if you go to the extreme, so for us from the point of view of the Babylonian Talmud, is the people in the eastern half. They're called the Easterners. So if you go to us, the people of the East, and he mentions that actually the emperor Shapur, actually his reign extended to the end, all the way to the extreme of the East. He said, for us, if you there is one of our days on the extreme East, where all 24 hours the moon will be non-visible, non-sightable, and although the entire process is 48 hours, but part of those 48 hours will be in one day, part of another will be so we're actually dealing with third days. Part of the first day, part of the last day, they'll be unsightable. But there's only one full day from the beginning of that day to the end of that day where the moon will be non-sightable. Let's say if it's a Sunday, so there'll be a little bit of Saturday, the entire Sunday, and a little bit of Monday. So that's how he explains, yes, there'll be 48 hours, but within, so he gives two spins on this. One spin is that 24 hours only the new, or the other is 24 hours not only the new, but it's the integrity of the entire day, a calendar day, from sunset to sunset. There'll only be one such day for any given location where that will, and in the extremity for us, the extremity of the east of habitation, that there'll be a little bit beforehand of the, for example, of Saturday, the entire Sunday, and the part of Monday, and how much of the Sunday will be of the old moon, and how much of that will be of the new moon. It says for us, 6 hours are the old. Okay, and then after, so that means that for 18 hours of Saturday and 6 hours of Sunday will be the old moon, then the conjunction will take place, and then there'll be 18 more hours of Sunday, and then there'll be 6 hours left afterwards, then into Monday, when it won't be sightable on that extremity. So that it'll be Sunday there. But if you go to the other 12 hours later, to the extremity of the west, it'll be the other way around. The only 18 hours for them, the day will even be a different day, and the proportions will be flipped. Without getting into all the details right now, so we're pretty much, I don't want to go too late, but that's, so he had, just a summary, he had to take certain basic principles of reality, of scientific reality, and he had to make this passage in the Talmud fit with those principles of the astronomical reality. He knows that it's close to 48 hours. There's no way to say it'll be 6 hours, no way to say that it'll be 24 hours. It has to be either 48 hours or almost 48 hours. No two ways about it. And then he also had to work out, when the rabbis spoke about the average, what was their point of orientation? Was it the land of Israel? And he astronomically goes in earlier chapters through proofs that it can't be the land of Israel. It has to be dead center, the navel of the earth. So he had to apply all of this astronomical reality to this passage, which is very obscure. And out of that, he managed to get a certain clarity, presuming that the editor of the passage had something coherent in mind. He recovered something coherent, whether it was exactly what the editor had in mind originally or not is a separate question, but at least he makes a narrative flow of it. He, you know, what the sociological issue is, why they were bothered, what the various obscure statements mean. So that's sort of just a little glimpse of Rabbi Isaac Nisraeli, it's the synthesis following on from Dr. Lowenthal of the preoccupation with astronomy that all these rabbis have. It actually fits in very nicely. So thank you. Yes.
So what I was actually going to say before, actually it's more relevant than I'm glad I waited when you made me wait, because there were two points that come to mind. First point, which I was going to raise, which I think was just to me distracting, was that I've been told that even though there are extensive discussions within the Talmud, of which this is one, about the various settings of the times, what they referred to was what the rabbis were thinking happened, let's say, in the days of the Anshei Knesset Gedolah, right, not in their time, because in their time, actually, you had to calculate it, and that's what they did. So, in fact, there wasn't, in the time when the Talmud was being edited, they already knew when all the times were from astronomical principles, which makes this even more interesting than looking at it your way around, if it's true, which you may not agree with, but because certainly by Isaac Israeli's time, they must have known, even if they couldn't do it themselves, that it was possible to calculate all these times very precisely without even looking at the sky. Just as you were saying that Menachem, the Babbage Rebbe, calculated when there was going to be an eclipse. Now that's another whole debate which we could go into with relation to the Babylonians and all the rest of it. But, so looking at it from the point of view of like where the science is relating to the religiosity of it, there's kind of all kinds of questions here.
Okay, and proceed, because I'm still waiting for
at the time the Talmud was written, and certainly in Isaac Israeli's time, did anyone actually do what it says you have to do in the Talmud, which is watch for the new moon? Did they do that?
The question is, the historical reality relating to these Mishnahs that speak in these passages. I don't know when that became discontinued. By Isaac Israeli's time, it was certainly discontinued.
Right.
The question, but the question is at the time, because he was 1310.
Yes.
Okay, the question is these earlier rabbis, Samuel and Rabbi Zerah, and things like that. That the question really applies
well,
to
that's
the.
One
know,
question. The yeah, other question is.
I don't know the answer to that.
Doing the editing, were they looking?
Hmm?
When this text was edited, at that time, were they really waiting for messengers from Jerusalem?
No, by that time they weren't. That's clear that they weren't.
Okay.
That by that time it was already that was
so
history.
Why don't they make an editorial comment to say nowadays we do it like this? Why do they just leave the whole thing so bare and not bring these later thoughts, which they could have attributed to a Namora or something like that, into the discussion?
Two very good questions. I'm incapable of answering either one of them. This is really going back to the redaction of the Talmud.
Mm.
This is I'm just working with Isaac Israeli.
And
that's someone like Sasha Stern would be the man to answer these questions. Yeah, he's the head of our project, of our research project.
But what you're saying is that what Isaac Israeli is trying to do is like he's saying, if you look at it from the scientist's point of view, which is what I'm doing, because I know it's 48 hours, how do I reconcile that with what the Talmud is telling us?
And also, how do you, that's part of it, and also how do you make sense of a passage that seems to embed very contradictory information from one sentence to the next?
Mm.
So there are several issues going on. There's a presumption, I think, that he's making that there is some coherence in the Talmud passage, which is probably a fair assumption. and But he reiterates, if you look at Rashi on the passage, I don't remember the exact wording, but Rashi doesn't seem so bothered to make things conform to astronomical reality.
Okay.
Israeli is very insistent on that. He says things have to be in the realm of what's possible and what actually occurs astronomically. He keeps on insisting that it has to make sense, it has to work in the world. I don't have the text here where he says it, but he reiterates that many times. Furthermore, he takes some of his colleagues to task, because he was not the first one to try to work this out. Many Sephardic rabbis tried to work on this. Rabbis living in an Islamicate civilization in Spain and other places in the East. And all the rabbis he quotes, except for Rashi, are actually from you know, Chaya Gaon and Rabbeinu Hananel. These people, in general, you know, and he quotes a bunch of others, Abraham Bar Chaya, Judah Halevi. Most of them are Sephardic rabbis. Or
is that an Ashkenazic rabbi?
Huh?
You're saying he's an Ashkenazic.
No, Rashi. Or Ashkenazic. No, he's also Sephardic.
He's also Sephardic.
Yeah, so this really, the people who are most interested in and most aware and most educated in the astronomy overwhelming were the Sephardic rabbis. Mm. Or the rabbis, I use Sephardic in a loose sense of those who are living in Islam, under an Islamic civilization. So he was not the first one to try to work this out, and others gave other solutions, and he wouldn't probably have gotten to where he had gotten to had they not made their earlier attempts. But he takes them to task for not actually having observed the skies, trying to confirm their interpretations of the. He said, if you had actually have observed the skies, you would have seen that your interpretation doesn't work. It's ingenious, but and he actually carried out measurements. Eclipses and things like that, and durations and things like that. So he is.
And is this recorded in the document?
Yes, it's recorded in this work, in the earlier chapters. Yeah, in Yesod Olam, yeah.
So is that the first time that, let's say, a commentator who was trying to explain the works of the rabbis also did experiments to try to show how to explain what they said?
I don't know. I don't know if it was the first time. That's a good question. That's something I should look into that.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay,
thank you. Yeah. Good questions. Thank you. Yeah. Thanks. A good way to end after a day of cerebral conversation to get into minute textual analysis of this.
I have a quick question. Yeah. Wasn't it controversial for them to do the Moilad in Barov? Because there's some Talmudic text about you're not allowed to do the Moilad outside Israel.
It's not this is not the question.
The greatest rabbi outside.
No, this is a big debate. This is not. That's what I thought that she was going to be asking about. That I presume that, but it's. He insists that there is a big debate about this that happened a couple hundred years before him. It was something that Sasha Stern is working on. That's very much associated with Saad Yagon, but he's saying that it should actually be less associated. Saad Yagon is probably not the main character in that, although he plays some role in it. But Israeli insists that it has to be done in the land of Israel. That's no two ways about it. But it seems, okay, but it seems that if you can know what's going to be decided in Israel, if you had a way of knowing what they were going to come up with, then you can rely on that locally. Which is, so it still has to be based on Israel somehow, but what's going to be decided in Israel, but, you can... The whole quest was to know what they're going to say in Israel if you have no way of finding out right away. So that's, Thank you. Yeah.
And the determination of the specific times, and forgive me because I probably don't know what I'm talking about, was that according to the time as in Israel, or the time according to this naval median, I suspect.
So the Molad times, he is in, that's a big debate, and he disagrees with earlier scholars who said, oh, it must be the land of Israel, or some said it must be the extreme east. And he said, and that's where he did his experiments, or he saw eclipses, and he worked out, you know, the parameters of where it must be, where it can't be. And he said it has to be along the equator on the navel of the earth. Smack dab right in the center. It won't work. None of the statements will work for any other locations. So that's, but he argues against earlier rabbis on that, who felt that it has to be the land of Israel or something another, for theological reasons, or that or others had different ways of calculating and said it must be the extremity of the east. That he demonstrates that it can't be any of that.
So why his demonstrations not refuted? It's not the right word. Contested.
Yeah. Or yeah, he, well, you can say refutes, maybe. I don't know, historically, you know, what ended up being the final word, but he actually brings proofs that what they say doesn't work. Objectively, it doesn't work.
So. Does he make any comment about, well, if this isn't true, what can we believe in the rest of the Talmud, or anything like that?
No, he makes a point that he raises the issue that for some reason the rabbis were very obscure. They never, they tried to. They're very quiet about where the molad. What the point for which we're, when we say the molad occurs at time X. What point we're talking about? And he raises the issue: why were they so quiet about that? Why didn't they just come out and say it's here or there? So
one hypothesis might be that because they think the molad is something that is cosmic and not to do. Like we were reading about Hanukkah, in the bit, part of Shabbat that deals with Hanukkah, it says when sunset. There's a discussion about when sunset, and in that point, one rabbi says sunset is while the earth is passing through the rakia or the whatever. I mean, so that's a completely different view of the universe.
Yeah, it works for only one, and from his scientific point of view, that works for only one place.
Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. So, yeah. But there's another element there that actually, there's some point on the Earth that is like omphalos, that's like the center, or what we're actually talking about is the cosmos moving and not the Earth.
Or some mythic conception. You know, I don't know the answer, but he raises the issue.
Yeah.
Well, you know, they were very explicit about other things, where that the sighting has to be done in the land of Israel, and you have the whole Mishnah discussion in Mishnah about can you send a message to Jerusalem by means of torches and things like that. So somehow something had to be determined in the land of Israel, and they're very clear about that. But what about the Molad? Why don't they ever mention, you know, where and what? Why doesn't anyone mention where the Molad is? And so I don't know if he actually came up with a satisfactory answer for himself. But
because, again, the word Molad, right, it means birth.
Yeah.
So you're almost being sent back to the kind of cosmic stories of a deity being born or something like that.
But is it a discussion between, to compare and contrast two huge paradigms, the scientific truth or the truth of the people, where they are, how they are, and time for them, as opposed to universal truth, mathematical, astronomical truth. Is there a tension?
There could be. That some of that comes up a little bit, but he seems to say that this needs to work. especially if it was used, if it ever really was used, there had to be an objective reality and system, the functioning here. So, however he feels that it just be that it became obscure, but not that he seems to presume that it was actually functioning at one time, and therefore, and then the passage was put together with some coherence, and therefore there is some sense somewhere along the way. But indeed, he I don't know if he ever comes up. I didn't finish the section where he deals
with
it. Yeah, but he raises a question. You know, why doesn't anyone mention where to orient the molad, and I don't think he actually, so far I don't think that he came up with he said maybe it's very esoteric or something like that. There is a secret somehow, but
we had soul already, didn't we?
Yeah. Which is, you know, what he's picking up on. This is one of the esoteric elements, but he can't figure out why they would want to keep it a secret.
Maybe it's not the secret. Maybe he discovers something which is accurate, but it might not be the actual thing, the secret.
Yeah. So I don't, you know, it's a lot to think about. A lot of I can't answer many of the big questions. I can just do my little piece here.
That's good. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to thank Dr. Salmon very much for a most interesting talk, a fascinating text. And with that, we close today's short seminar, where we had Meir Wax, who's at the Faculty of Theology, spoke about Darkei Shalom, ways of peace, regarding the waterways in Babylon. And then I gave a talk on Moses of Oxford, of London, and his grappling with society he lived in connection with Jewish law, and living in England, in Oxford, with all the challenges of civil society and different issues that came up. And the theme of, I guess, connecting these talks is how Judaism relates to the real world. You've got Jewish teaching, but then you've got the real fabric of society and how it interacts. So the ways of peace, that is one way the rabbis set premises. There are realities which we have to adapt with and we deal with and recognize and find harmony. And then, of course, medieval times, the realities which has to be dealt with and which Jewish law recognized and adapted in many ways. And that, of course, brings to Dr. Lowenthal's talk on the Rebbe's formative years, the sciences and pursuit of knowledge. Again, not seeing conflict, but harmony between the Torah and the world. And which brings us to the last talk, of course, the rabbi's great knowledge of the sciences, dealing with the new month, and therefore the holidays and the laws pertaining to the holidays, all interconnected with this. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.